Usually I like to make a joke here, but today I'm just depressed. If anyone out there can play quarterback, can you just call the New York Jets, like right now? Welcome to Triple Click, where we bring the games to you. This week we are opening up the mailbag and taking all sorts of questions, from PS5 controllers to Resident Evil and where to start getting into the series. I'm Jason Schreier.
I'm Kirk Hamilton.
And I'm Maddie Myers.
Hello.
It's us again.
Hey, hello.
Hello, my friends, and welcome back for another week.
Nice
to see you both.
Wow. Man,
happy Thanksgiving to both of you and to everyone out there. This episode is arriving Thanksgiving morning, like a Thanksgiving present underneath your turkey. Triple Click is arriving.
Your turkey tree that, you know, people tend
to right there underneath the turkey.
Stuffed inside your turkey is a new episode of Triple Click.
A buttery present that's got a little bit of stuffing right on top of it.
Exactly. Well, some people make a turducken. We make a turklicken.
That's right.
For everyone.
It's a podcast inside of an iPod inside of a turkey.
If you would like to continue receiving podcasts inside of your turkeys, then hey, you should help us make this show possible by becoming a member of our network, Maximum Fun. Go to MaximumFun.org/join and you can support our show, because we don't have any advertisers. We are only able to make this happen and continue to get paid to spend our valuable time doing this every single week because of all of you valuable listeners out there, you wonderful listeners out there. You guys are just as valuable as our time, if not more so. Go to MaximumFun.org/join, become a supporter of our show. And in addition to, as I always say, that warm, fuzzy feeling that one gets when they're supporting their favorite podcast, you will also get access to our bonus content. We release a new bonus episode every single month, including the one we are about to put out, which is a giant spoiler-filled, spoiler-packed story discussion. And who knows what else we're going to discuss. Maybe we'll even discuss things that aren't the story. Beanscast, we call it, because we're going to spill the beans on God of War Ragnarok. We are going to dive deep into that game. Save this bonus episode for until you've finished it. But if you have finished it and you're eager to hear us talk about it, now is your chance. So become a member today and you will get that very soon. We also have a new merch store. Kirk, you want to shout out the new merch in our store?
Yeah, we have new merch in our store. that's pretty much it.
But what is
we've
it?
Had t-shirts available in the past, but now we are going through a new way of getting t-shirts in addition to that one. And so there are new t-shirts with new colors that you can order. There's a mug. There's a sticker. I just spent a lot of money on merch from my own podcast. There's a link for it down in the show notes. And I think we're going to add some more stuff down the line. But for now, there's already some new stuff you can get. And that, of course, supports us and supports Maximum Fun. So you'll find the link for that down in the show notes. Get some merch. Get a shirt. Get a mug.
Mm-hmm. Get a sticker.
Yes.
Why not?
Get a sticker. I got a couple stickers.
I'm going to buy a mug for sure. Black Friday is coming up. Holiday season is coming up. This is like a perfect opportunity.
We don't have any Black Friday deals that I know of. However, it is coming
so,
up.
No.
Get your friends and family some Triple Click gear. All right. On with the episode. This week, we are reaching into the old question bag and answering some questions from all of you fine folks. A lot of really good ones.
And the bag is on fire, as usual. The bag
it is.
It is
a burning mailbag. Some burning questions.
It's very dangerous to reach in there.
We get so many good questions. I read through them all. Some of them I wish we could answer, but we cannot. We only have so much time in the day. But we got some really good ones. And just to remind you all, you can reach us with questions or whatever else you'd like at tripleclick@maximumfun.org. tripleclick@maximumfun.org. On with the mailbag. All right. Maddie, start us off with the first question.
Sure. So this one is from Chase, who writes, "Hi, Triple Click. I've had a PS5 for a while now, and I'm wondering what you all think of the much-hyped controller and its advanced haptics. I thought the way Returnal used it for the Alt-Fire was interesting, but not necessary. It worked well, but I'm not dying for other games to do the same thing. In Horizon Forbidden West, I turned off the bit where it makes it harder to draw your bowstring back because it got obnoxious really fast, but I did enjoy the feeling of really having to crunch down the trigger for actions like opening a stuck door or chest. Those are really the only times I can think of where games use the PS5 controller's haptics beyond standard rumble. Am I missing anything cool? What do you all think of the feature now that it's been around for a while? Will it be a forgotten novelty, or will it become an integral part of the future of gaming?
So, Kirk, you had dropped a comment. We were going through these questions saying, let's wait till after God of War Ragnarok to talk about this, because God of War Ragnarok felt like a good time to talk about this, because the PS5 has now been out for exactly 2 years on the dot. And, I'm curious to hear what you guys think, and I have my own thoughts, too.
So I would start by drawing a distinction between haptics and trigger pressure, because I think those are two different technologies, and that one is kind of cooler and I could see it being used more than the other, by which I mean the haptics are pretty cool and the trigger thing is a little more gimmicky. So most of what Chase is talking about is stuff with the triggers, which, to anyone who doesn't have a PS5, the triggers on the new DualSense controller, newish DualSense controller, can do like variable resistance. So in Returnal, you know, you would pull the trigger halfway to shoot, but then you could jam it all the way down and kind of break through a resistance wall, and that would cause the secondary fire, which, yeah, that was cool, but didn't really feel essential, and you could turn it off. So that, I don't know, like, that trigger stuff is, like, neat. I like the idea of resistance in haptics in controllers, but I agree that there aren't a lot of use cases that come to mind, especially because not everyone has this controller, and as a result, you can't really build game mechanics around it. I played a lot of God of War Ragnarok on the Steam Deck, just streaming it, and sometimes I can get the rumble to work streaming via Chiaki, and even when it does and when it doesn't make a huge difference, but the trigger thing is just not there at all, like the vibrating triggers, so it's not a big deal. But I think the haptics are pretty cool. I didn't miss them playing God of War Ragnarok without feeling the really advanced stuff. But whenever I played it with the DualSense, I definitely noticed it. And it wasn't just like it happens a couple times. Everything in the game really triggers the haptics in some way because, as a guest explained on our show a long time ago, the way that the technology works, it allows for these really subtle, quick shifts between intensity of rumble. I wouldn't even call it rumble. So like little footsteps or falling water or even sound effects, things that you'll hear, very subtle shifts along with big loud things. Like, you kind of feel all of that in your hands in a way that's pretty cool. I think that it's well implemented in God of War, and that kind of thing I could see becoming the standard. It just feels like a better version of existing technology. It's just a matter of who will adopt it and when.
You cannot put your controller on your desk or your table during a cutscene
or else
it will fall off. It will just vibrate its way to the ground.
Yeah, I feel like that's the main thing I notice about the haptics, is that I don't really notice them that much when I'm holding the controller, because they're often so well incorporated into a game, God of War Ragnarok included. But then if I put my controller down for a second, maybe to have a couple chips or what have you, suddenly I'm like, holy crap, the controller is freaking out. And it's kind of interesting, because a lot of times it's a pretty gentle rumble or just a little bit of a sensation that you just don't scarcely notice, but it is adding a little something extra.
Don't you think they'll make it so that the controller can tell when it's been set down and it'll stop doing that? Because that is annoying when it does that.
Yeah, why doesn't it know everything about what I'm doing? Why isn't my controller like, oh, Maddie's feeling a little hungry now?
And it's got like an accelerometer in it. I feel like it could probably already tell when it's been set down on a table. So it seems like that'll happen at some point.
The controller should really be feeding you chips, Maddie.
That's also true. Like... I think that the controller should have a little chip compartment at the bottom. Kirk wants those back buttons. I just want chips in there because I want it to get really dirty.
Sony should come out with a feed bag that feeds you as you're playing.
Oh my god, this is the future of gaming. I have like one of those little finger things like you get in the hospital, and it like tells me how I'm doing, my heart rate and everything, how many chips I need to win.
So yeah, I think the triggers are pretty cool. Sometimes they're a little like off-putting, I guess, but like in general I like them. You mentioned Returnal, I thought that was a pretty cool way of doing it, where it like felt like it had different functionality. But also, like, I don't know, Although you're right in that there's only so much that can be done when all of these games are coming to multiple platforms, and so it's very difficult for companies to justify spending the time and resources on PS5 specific stuff. But when a game is PS5 only or PlayStation only, then it's easier to justify. And so, like, I remember really enjoying the haptics in Spider-Man Miles Morales. I remember they were fun in Bugsnacks, which isn't PS5 only, but it was like a console launch exclusive or whatever. And so, yeah, I don't know. I've enjoyed it. I like the way that I like it when it's like a soft press feels one way and then a harder press feels another way. It kind of feels neat in a way. And so with Ragnarok specifically, I enjoyed the parts where it's kind of like a little QTE where it's like cut or like chop this tree or whatever, and you feel a little bit more resistance on the trigger. Yeah, I don't know. I like it. It's definitely not as impressive as it was when I first checked it out a couple of years ago. But yeah, I definitely enjoy it.
It is also nice that as these games that are originally released on PS5 come to PC, usually there's DualSense support. And wasn't it Deathloop that actually had some DualSense stuff built in because mm-hmm. it was kind of a PlayStation console exclusive? So that's kind of nice that if you plug a DualSense into a PC on an increasing number of games, you get those extra little features.
Mm-hmm. Yep. I love that because I personally think it's the most comfortable of my controller lineup now.
It is a really comfortable controller. I do really just like using it. Agreed.
Yeah, well, that's the thing. I think that's really the biggest highlight of the controller is that it just feels great. Mm-hmm. And the haptic stuff feels like a nice little bonus, but it's mm-hmm. just a good controller to begin with. All right, let's get to the next question. Kirk, you want to do this?
Sure. Eric writes, I was so close to the end of both Planescape Torment and Fallout New Vegas, but life intervened and I never finished them. I'm so close to the end of The Witcher 3 Blood and Wine now, but as a single parent, I just haven't completed it yet, and I get a little anxious. I'll somehow lose my save and won't be able to. Are there any games you regret not finishing? There's a few, but Man, Eric, I hope that you manage to finish The Witcher Blood and Wine because it has a really good ending. It's especially if you like The Witcher. The ending is really good.
Man, mm-hmm. this happens to me all the time. It's so difficult. At least I find it very difficult to like switch from a game to another on one platform and then try to revisit it like a month later. So like mm-hmm. once my PS5 moves from like, I don't know, Gotham Knights to God of War, I'm not going back to Gotham Knights.
But why not? Yeah. What do you mean?
No, but maybe that's even a bad comparison. I don't know. There are a lot of games where like I'm enjoying them just fine, but then I spend a month on another thing and it's like, oh God, I have to learn how to play this game again. Yep. We've talked about this before, but I think so many games could really benefit from like a message saying, oh, you haven't played this in 4 weeks.
Yes.
Mm-hmm. Like, here's what you need to know. Here are the controls. Right. Here's
like a crash
course
tutorial.
A story briefing.
Like the Netflix recap that they give you if you haven't watched a show for a certain amount of time. Like they've started programming that in. Why don't games
like,
do that?
It'll be like you start Netflix and they're like, you haven't used Netflix in a while. Here's how you press play.
Yeah, here's how
you rewind. Here's how Netflix
works. What if you've forgotten how to click on rectangles?
Mm-hmm. We thought we were worried. You might have forgotten.
Yeah, I have so many examples, by the way. If we want to just list our buckets of shame. I mean, Dark Souls 1 is like perhaps the most obvious one. Mm-hmm. I keep trying to go back and being
But you play that every day for 40 years, so like you're gonna finish it.
I've never beaten Persona 5, which I feel increasingly sad about because I feel like I would get to know you two better if I did. You know, we have more things we could talk about. I mean, mm-hmm. the list goes on. I feel like there's
and Hollow Knight, right?
Those Hollow Knight, yeah. I've never
the Rosetta Stones
Hollow Knight,
for Kirk and Jason,
right? Bloodborne. I don't feel that guilty about it, but like sometimes I kind of do. I mean, it's like anything I've started and played 10 plus hours of. Although Eric is describing a worse version of that, which is like being almost done and then just somehow never quite finding the time to finish it up, which I think is worse.
Well, and that can sometimes be, I'm not saying this is what Eric is doing, but that can sometimes be not wanting the game to end, right?
Yes.
I mean, I know
people.
I have some friends who have never watched the final two episodes of 30 Rock.
What?
Just because they really loved the show and they watched it together and then it ended and they just never really did it, which I've definitely done for shows where I'm like, oh, Star Trek The Next Generation, actually. We watched the entire show and have like 4 episodes left and we just never watched them. And it's partly not wanting to finish it. That's kind of a different thing, but Eric's email does make me think of that. I'll say that there one game that I really want to finish that I never finished is Assassin's Creed Rogue, which is the only Assassin's Creed game, mainline Assassin's Creed anyway, that I haven't finished. It's the one that's the most tied up with the lore, with like Haytham and the Kenways and the whole Assassin's Creed 3 storyline. Our former boss Stephen Totilo loves the game, and you know, he has always wanted me to finish it just because he and I like to nerd out about all of the deep lore of Assassin's Creed. And I've never finished it. And I've played like a few hours of it. I've gotten kind of far, but I just can never quite get the momentum going. And he trolls me about it constantly. So at some point, I really want to finish that game.
Great.
That's the nice thing about remasters. Maybe Rogue will get remastered one day, so you have an excuse to.
Yeah.
But then you have to start over. I feel like that isn't always a good thing. Although Kirk has proven us all wrong by constantly replaying something that has been recently remastered over the course of his lifetime.
Right. Both actually Divinity Original Sin and Persona 5, which I think is what you're referring to. I'm going to finish Persona 5. Maybe not till next year, but I'm in the final the final chunk of that, the new royal part. It's pretty cool.
Oh, you got to the new dungeon already.
Oh, yeah. I'm doing all the new
stuff.
Oh,
then you should finish pretty soon. Like, it's not that long.
It's more that there's a lot of stuff I want to finish that's like games for this year, for our games and review stuff that I'm sort of focusing on first.
Got it. Yeah, so I have a giant, like, I look through my Steam backlog and there are a bazillion things where it's like, oh, yeah, I should finish that one day. Mm-hmm. I should finish this game.
Once I uninstall something, it's over. There's always a point where start decluttering my Steam list and I'm just like, I'm never going to finish this.
Yeah.
And then I just move on.
Yeah,
guess how long I've had Dark Souls 1 installed? Guess how long it will be installed? Forever.
Forever, maybe.
25 years.
Wow, it's weird that I'm going to die in 25 years.
Since the Carter administration.
You've had it installed since 1997.
Wow. I always wish that, like, I always play 10 hours of every single Tales game, you know, the Tales series, Tales of something. I always play 10 hours, and then something else comes out, and I have to switch to that for whatever reason, and then never go back to the Tales games. But every single time, I'm like, oh, this is fun. I should finish this. But no, never can, never do.
Yeah, I can see that with those kinds of JRPGs.
Totally.
All right, next question. Here is Steven. Steven says, I watched the new Netflix Resident Evil series recently, which inspired me to finally check out the games. The problem is there's so many of them now that I don't know where to begin. Do you guys have any recommendations for where to start or which games to avoid altogether? Thanks and love the show, Steven.
Oh, Steven. I have recommendations for you.
You guys have stronger thoughts on this than I do.
Here we go. I'm looking at the Wikipedia page now.
So, all right. So I have a recommendation. I have three games that I think you should consider. There's some nuance to the recommendations, but I do have one that I think I would recommend that Steven play. If you want to play a really great Resident Evil experience, that's just a good game that also gives you a sense of what Resident Evil is all about, in my opinion, you should play Resident Evil 2 Remake. That's my take. I think it's my favorite of all of the Resident Evils that I've played, which is not all of them. Not a super expert or anything, but I've played a number of them, and that game is awesome. And it has, like, it's a remake of an older Resident Evil game, so it has a lot of the kind of fundamental stuff, but because it's a remake, it's amazing looking, it's over the shoulder, it feels more modern, a little more like Resident Evil 4, and it's just a really cool game. So that's my first thought.
If you started 2, are you missing out on any parts of the ongoing story?
It's not that complicated of an ongoing story, is the good
news. I mean,
news.
It is both very, very complicated and also not that complicated.
Yes, that's precisely right. Where there's always a zombie apocalypse, there's always some type of super science organization that's evil and has some type of money-related or crime lord-related motivations for causing the zombie apocalypse. But it's okay if you aren't following every single supervillain who's ever created a zombie. There's a whole bunch of them. It's okay if you aren't following every single STARS agent. There's a bunch of them. You'll get the gist. You're going to play as somebody who's got a gun, somebody who's really cool, and they're going to fight zombies.
This sounds like the MCU. It's like, yeah, there's an ongoing story, but you can
jump in. It is a sci-fi series, yeah.
And I would say that Resident Evil 2 Remake is pretty clean. I mean, you come in, you play as two people. Claire Redfield, she's just this girl who is trying to survive, and Leon, who's a cop in Raccoon City. And the two of you are like in the middle of a zombie apocalypse and you have to go through this really wild police station and then there's some adventures in the sewers and whatever. You get into like an umbrella facility and you learn, oh, there's this facility here and they've been making zombies. Like, it's all pretty self-contained. There's not like a sequence really in Resident Evil 2 where like Albert Wesker appears and gives a big monologue about some shit that happened in the first game and you're like, who is this guy? What's going on? Like,
that does happen in Resident Evil 5, unfortunately. But that would
that's
be one
why
of the
I
ones
would definitely
I don't recommend.
Not recommend that game.
No, Wesker monologues a lot in that one, and you don't need any of it.
The 2 remakes. So, Maddie, do you agree with Kirk's suggestion?
I do. I think the remakes are great because they're just examples of easy-to-play versions of stories that I already really like. But I would actually recommend the original Resident Evil. It's already been remade a bunch of times. Mm-hmm. There's like a 2002-era remake of it. I think the original year it came out was 96. Yeah, that's right. I played the 2002 remake on the GameCube, and I actually dug that pretty well, but it's out for every single platform at this point. I recommend it because it's kind of like a Silent Hill 2 situation. It's a classic for a reason. It's really simple. It's not super long, and it's legit kind of scary at parts, even though it's really pixelated looking. Some of that is just the pacing and the weird dialogue and just the way the mansion looks. It's just got a certain tone. And again, it's not like you need to play the first one for story reasons. It's more just that it's got a cool vibe. I don't even know if you need to beat it, but I feel like it'll show you something about the overall atmosphere of these games and how small they originally started. Like, it's called Resident Evil because it's about just a couple people, like a evil resident in a house of a creepy person who is a zombie. And that really, really small scale is part of what's so cool about the first game. It's just, you're just walking around some rooms of just one house. That's it.
So the remasters that you mentioned, or the remakes you mentioned, is the first game remade the way that like 2 and some of the others?
No, so let me add a little more nuance, and I'll include Resident Evil 1 Remake, because there's a little more to my recommendation than just that I think Resident Evil 2 Remake is the good way to go. And this maybe will just be helpful, Stephen, depending on what your tastes are.
Yes.
And that is each one of the, there's kind of three types of Resident Evil game, and it has to do with where the camera is located. There's the fixed camera, there's over-the-shoulder third person, and there's first person. So the Resident Evil 1 Remake is a fixed camera game, which does kind of limit it. Like, you're playing a game that feels more old-fashioned because the camera is just set, you know, it'll be like at one point in the hallway and you walk around relative to it, which is kind of clunky and old-fashioned feeling, but very cool. Once you get into the groove of it, you're like, oh, okay, I get this. It just feels a little older. Resident Evil 2, so that's Resident Evil 1 Remake. Resident Evil 2 Remake is over the shoulder, so it looks like a Last of Us or whatever, a modern sort of third-person game, which is really easy to adjust to. And then I would also say you could consider playing Resident Evil 7 or Resident Evil 8, because those are both good games, and they're both first-person.
4 is the first in the series that is starting the over-the-shoulder action-based play, which, I mean, 4 is kind of... I don't know. What are you going to say, Kirk?
Well, so I wouldn't include 4 in this because 4 is about to get a remake. And I would say just wait for that and play that, because I think it'll be a lot like the original. It'll just sort of be a little smoother and a little better looking because the original holds up. I'd say, like, if you're going to play an over-the-shoulder one, play 2 Remake. If you want to play a fixed position one that's like the original, play the first one. And if you want to play a modern one, there's 7 and 8. And I would say the difference between those two is that both of them have the same strengths and weaknesses. They're both first person. They're both fun. They both eventually devolve into like kind of more Resident Evil lore than you might want as a newcomer.
Yeah.
They both kind of have that same thing where two thirds of the way in, suddenly it is actually Wesker. He doesn't actually appear, but it's that idea. Like, okay, wait, what the hell is happening? Which isn't a huge deal because they're fun games. But the difference I would say is that 7 is really scary, especially the first half of 7 is like a legitimately scary game. That's the scariest of the four that I'm listing here. And 8 is a little more action-packed and silly and
goofy.
Fun.
Yeah.
Yeah. It still's got its moments of tenseness, but it's not as scary as 7. Mm-hmm. So that, I'd say any of those four, depending on how they sound to you, from the first person, third person, fixed camera, etc. But still, my overall recommendation is 2 Remake, just because it's an awesome game. It's my favorite of all of the Resident Evil games I've ever played.
I feel like I need to add, based on the fact that Steven said that they watched the Resident Evil Netflix series, that you should probably just play 8. Because it's the goofiest one, and the Netflix series, from all accounts, is incredibly goofy.
Okay,
so
I think
if you like the Netflix series... Our friend Gita really liked it, so I got kind of a recap on how goofball it is. There's like a bunch of Wesker clones in it, and there's a lot of like clone-on-clone goofballery. Sure. And so if you like the goofy stuff of Resident Evil, then I would say just play the newest one. And then if you're enjoying that, then maybe you'll enjoy circling back and playing some of the more serious ones. But it's not always goofy. They're pretty different in tone, even though they're all theoretically in the same world.
It's a cool series to get into just because there's so many of them, and a lot of them are very good. And some of them aren't as good, but a lot of them are good.
Unfortunately, that's everything that's in a series, but oh well.
Yeah, that's true.
It's an interesting series to get into because all of them are constantly being remade.
That's true.
And just re-released every year.
Yeah,
which I see as a great thing about it is that they're always accessible. Like, just wait a couple more years and whichever Resident Evil you want to play is either about to get a remaster or a port or a full remake. Somewhere on a console of your choosing.
All right, next question. Maddie, take us away.
So Kevin writes, Thousands of years ago, all the way back in 2021, Nintendo released Metroid Dread for the Nintendo Switch. It is fantastic, and I love it. Shortly thereafter, within a week, as I recall, Kotaku published an article about how much better it ran on PC via emulation. I'm curious as to your collective thoughts on this. How do you all feel about this whole situation? Apparently, Kotaku no longer gets pre-release copies of games. How do you feel about that? Do you feel that Nintendo is justified in removing Kotaku from pre-release access based on these events?
So, okay, so a couple of things. Well, a couple of things to lay out here. So, yeah. First of all, I'm not actually sure if Kotaku has said or if they know for sure. Generally, you don't know for sure about these things, that Nintendo is kind of blackballing them because of this one specific article. Like, there could be a lot of reasons they've done it. Also, Nintendo, kind of like a little bit of inside baseball here, is that Nintendo has cracked down on pre-release copies for everybody over the last 2 years specifically, and started doing some, like, making people jump through hoops to get early access to games, and it's very limited. And so it's kind of like, it could, I don't know for sure what the deal is with Kotaku, but the article itself, I think, is interesting. If you look at the article now, and we can link this in the show notes, there are actually a couple of updates, including one that is like, the original, we apologize because the original article did not meet our editorial standards, because a lot of readers interpreted it as Kotaku saying, hey, go download this game because it runs better on PC than it does on Switch, which I think is another, is kind of like an interesting, there are like different ways to go about something like this, right? Like, you can kind of like report on emulation in a very neutrally toned, kind of like straightforward way. You can editorialize a little bit. You can add thoughts on like how much better it runs. There are a lot of just like different nuances. And it sounds like Kotaku, our old website, our alma mater, it sounds like they felt like they went a little bit too far in that direction. But the article itself, as it stands right now, is Metroid Dread is already running on Switch emulators is the title, and it's about how Nintendo is in this thorny spot where the game is running better on PC emulators than it is on the Switch, because the Switch is such old hardware. So yeah, that's where it's at. I don't know. Curious to hear what you guys think of this whole situation. I do think that emulators are a really interesting topic, and personally, my kind of personal opinion is that emulators are only really kind of justifiable on if you can't buy a game in a way that is like legally, like, that will actually benefit the people involved, right? So like, when it comes to old games, I feel a lot differently than about emulators than I do about games that came out yesterday. But yeah, curious to hear your thoughts.
I think also people generally feel that if they own a game, then emulating it elsewhere is sort of considered ethical. But there is a difference between privately doing that and writing an article about it. And if you were to write an article about it on a widely read website, and this is something that we have to think about at Polygon too and on the show, you run the risk of suggesting to people that they should do that instead of purchasing the game, which in some cases can actually harm the people who made it because it's like an indie game or whatever. This is sort of a weird situation where Nintendo is not an indie. And I remember that being the argument of
the
time.
Well, that's what's interesting, because Metroid fans were like, man, it's been 15 years since a new Metroid game. Like, you got to do this to us, Kotaku. I remember people getting really mad about that.
Like, defending Nintendo's honor and Samus Aran's honor,
because Metroid is like, people just, I think, for whatever reason, I don't know how much of this is justifiable, how much of this is just like capitalism poisoning, but there's this belief that like, this game has to sell well so we get more entries in the series, which like makes sense, right? But it's also kind of twisted. There's a lot of interesting nuance to unpack there.
Yeah, but I feel like on the other end of the spectrum, I don't ever feel that great talking about using emulators, even though I don't feel unethical. For example, if I were to use one to play Suikoden 2, I don't feel great.
To be fair, important context here, before the remaster was announced,
correct.
So when we had no idea that there was going to be a way to legally like buy it anytime soon.
It's tough, because I've certainly said all the music I've released, I will send it to anyone for free if anyone is to ask me. That stands true. I don't mind if people share it amongst themselves. But I also understand that capitalism exists and that some people really don't feel that way. And we could really go down the rabbit hole of just the studies about how usually people who pirate games and other media aren't the same people who would have bought it anyway. And is this even like a worthwhile conversation to have from a financial perspective? Because would those people have ever been interested in the game? That's almost separate, but from the reporting side.
Yeah, the reporting side is the big question here, I think, at least from our perspectives, is like podcasters with a platform, reporters with a platform, like how do you approach something like this? What's the ethical way to approach something like this? If you're a reporter and you see this thing happening and you want to talk about it, I mean, I think the issue here is that, like, I think it's when you're writing and editing a story, and every website obviously has different tones that they use. But if you're not going for, like, the quote-unquote neutral style that, like, a mainstream news organization like a New York Times or a Bloomberg News would take, and you're writing in that kind of colorful bloggy way that the three of us did for many years, you risk putting yourself in a trap. Like, you write a sentence in a little, like, a wrong way, a little too much opinion into this one, a little bit too much about how amazing the game looks when it's running on PC. That's when you can kind of get yourself into trouble, I think.
Mm-hmm. And it's too bad, because in this case, I do think it's an interesting story. And I thought that at the time, although, I mean, I don't have a copy of the original draft or any of that. But I do think there is a way to write about it ethically in this case and be like, you know, what happened with the OLED? What's happening with chip shortages? Uh-huh. Why doesn't the Switch have an improved version that could have run this game and not higher def way? And we kind of can see that the game is capable of that, but the hardware isn't. And that's the part of the story that I think is worth reporting on. It's just that in order to report that, you have to talk about an illegal method of running the game.
Which I think is fine. I think you just have to be careful when you're
right
cheerleading that, or at least coming across as if you do. And then there's some people who would argue, hey, like, you shouldn't talk about this because talking about this alerts to the fact that it exists.
Correct.
I mean, with Kotaku, we were always like, every time there was a fan game or something that, like, based on licensed property, there was always a contingent of readers that would get mad if we wrote about it, because it would be like, hey, now Nintendo's going to send their copyright lawyers with their cease and desist to pull this thing. Like, mm-hmm. Thanks a lot for calling all this attention to it. Now it won't exist anymore.
Yeah.
So that's another aspect of this.
Yeah.
The updates on this Kotaku article are really interesting, by the way. There's one that says, editor's note, per request by Nintendo, we have updated the article to generally reassert that Kotaku does not promote or encourage piracy. Kotaku declined to enact changes that blur the line between suggestions and aggressive line edits to preserve editorial independence.
Those must have been some stressful emails.
Some emails happened there.
Some emails definitely happened. All right, let's move on. Kirk, you want to read the next one?
Sure. This comes from Eric, who writes, my question to you three is, what are your thoughts on the importance or unimportance of usernames, gamer tags, etc. in games and the overall gaming community? For example, I wouldn't have thought all those years ago when I was choosing my Xbox Live gamer tag that there would be a whole group of people that only knew me as my online moniker, and I might have put a little more thought into it had I known.
shout out to Sephiroth 420 XXXX.
Yeah, right. I've written articles about this, so I'll link to
IDP
this.
It was
the modes of the major scale. So Ionian, Dorian, Phrygian, Lydian, Mixolydian,
so
Aeolian,
cool.
Locrian.
Yeah.
So yeah, cool. Man, because, you know, I like music.
Seems to me.
I had a nerd.
I do. And I wanted, well, no one actually could tell that from my username.
Yeah. I wonder why that is. Nobody ever went to you and was like, oh my God, is that...
I know what that is.
Is that the first letter of every name of the types of scale?
No, but I would have been best friends with whoever the person was. But I never met them. I wrote about this. So I did something very similar to Eric, where I had this stupid username that I hated because it wasn't really a word. And then finally, because Sony took so long to implement the ability to change your handle, that when they finally did, I changed it.
Which is so common now across all platforms and games that you can change your handle. I mean, sometimes they'll charge you for it, but it's always an option. And in the early days, in the olden days, you got what you got.
Yeah, I think that then answers the question a little bit, Eric's question, which is, yeah, I don't think any of us knew that those names were going to wind up having this big life outside of ourselves, that we would be stuck with them for so long that they would become how people in MMOs that we maybe played a lot, like in my case with Destiny, for so long. It was like people would, they couldn't even, they'd be like, IDP, you go over here. It sucked. Cause like, you know, it, now my handle is Kirkhammer. So they can just be like, oh, Kirk, go over here. Like they'll see my name. Uh-huh. And that's much easier in a game like Destiny. So I think we didn't know, and no one really knew because it was sort of a new thing. And now, like you said, Maddie, it's just way more established that you get a handle that's like a name with a bunch of numbers. And then there's a second layer on top of it, like how Discord works, how Xbox works now, where you can pick whatever you want. You can change it whenever you want. You can have it look different in different games, because that's like a much better way to do things. And that's probably how they would have engineered things from the start. Like, clearly it was very difficult on an engineering level for Sony to retroactively, you know, to retrofit the ability to change your handles. That's why it took them so long. So now I think anyone who's building a platform builds that in.
Mm-hmm. I mean, I will say I don't think they're important even now, which is part of why it's so funny that now you can change them, because I think that suggests that you put thought into it because you have the ability to change it. So having a dumb name, which I would say I do on most platforms, have a series of very stupid names, you chose that. Like, now I feel like it's almost worse. It's not like you can be like, well, I chose this when I was 12. You know how it is. It's like, no, you chose that last week and you're going with that. Like, you're going right with, like, I don't know, Batman Stoner. I mean, that's what you're going with. That's the face you're putting out to the world.
The important thing is that you put parody account next to whatever it is.
Yeah. Well, nowadays you can be verified Batman Stoner. You can be Twitter verified Batman Stoner for only $8 a month. All right,
just
last question.
That you tell everyone it's a parody.
One last question. This is from Christian. Ironically, given his question, Christian writes, "Hi Trippers, now that God of War 2018 and Ragnarok are out, given the original series and also Assassin's Creed Origins, we can surely ask the vital question, which is the best pantheon, Greek, Norse, or Egyptian? Are those the only three options? I feel like there must be other pantheons of gods out there, but regardless, that's his question.
For some reason, we're not including the Christian pantheon at all. We're not including Lucifer. We're not including Paradise Lost or any
spoken
of that.
Spoken like someone who just played Dante's Inferno.
I mean, there were a lot of people in that game. I'll say it. They were in there.
There's a lot of characters in the Bible.
It's not a pantheon when there's only one God, and that's kind of the whole point.
Okay, sure. But there are prophets and like people with powers and angels. There's angels and demons with names.
We're talking about pantheons of gods, Greek, Norse, Egyptian.
I like Egyptian the best. Everyone already knows that. I think it's the coolest. Assassin's Creed Origins, great game. Can't wait for God of War to go to Egypt. It's totally going to happen, folks. Arthurian legends? No way. They're going to Egypt next. Come on, Corey Farlug. You listen to the show? Make it happen, man.
Yeah, they hinted at that in the last game,
yeah,
but we'll save that for the Beans cast. Kirk, any thoughts?
I don't know. No, I think... I don't know. I don't have a strong take
on
this.
Do you not want to officially call which one is the coolest? Why not?
to pick the best ancient religion.
I don't know. I always had a soft spot for Greek because I grew up like reading all this Greek mythology. I have that one book full of them. And I always thought those were the wildest stories. But Norse has some pretty cool stories too. I'm not as familiar with the Egyptian.
Yeah,
Egyptian,
whereas I grew up reading mythology, like the Egypt game.
Right.
Book, everything, and being so into mm-hmm. that as a child. And then we had this huge ancient Egyptian art book in my house, and I would just like put post-it notes on all the pages that had cats on them, which is a lot of pages.
Probably quite a few. Yeah, I think they're all neat. I mean, a thing that I like in God of War Ragnarok is whenever Mimir asks Kratos about a story, you know, he'll be talking about the Iliad or something, and they'll sort of paraphrase the Iliad, and he'll be like, oh, I think I heard that story. And just the idea that there's sort of cross-pollinization between these stories was kind of fun. But no, I mean, I can't pick a favorite, just partly because I only really know what I've learned from playing God of War forever ago or Assassin's. Like, I have never sat down and read. I haven't even read Norse mythology.
It might not be 100% accurate. It might not be.
No, but I mean, I can't pick a favorite based just on that. They're all very interesting, clearly. And I'm sure each game also presents a sort of its own unique view of what people actually believe. But I do want to read Norse mythology after you talking about it, Jason, and then after playing so much God of War.
Yeah, the Neil Gaiman book is fantastic. Mm-hmm.
It's definitely something I liked about Moon Knight and like about Thor, yes, is that it brought Norse and Egyptian mythology sort of more center screen in pop culture, which is pretty fun.
You know, people cross-pollinated in real life, you know? All those different cultures. Everybody talked to each other before long. And that's kind
of
neat.
It's particularly funny playing Ragnarok and seeing their portrayal of Odin and Thor versus like the MCU's portrayal of Thor and Odin. It's pretty funny.
It is.
All right, cool. Let's take a break. Once again, thank you to everybody who sent in questions. They were all great. And keep sending them in. We love them. We'll keep doing these episodes as long as we keep getting good questions. Once again, tripleclick@maximumfun.org to reach us. All right, let's take a break and we'll be back with one more thing.
Manolo, guess what? Manolo, guess what?
What?
Doctor Game Show has made it to 100 episodes on Maximum Fun.
Oh, that's true. I knew that.
Well, to celebrate, we are releasing our entire Earwolf archives to Max Fun members. That's anyone who gives $5 or more monthly to support podcasts like Doctor Game Show.
That's 63 episodes with in-studio comedian guests like Jason Mantzoukas, Bowen Yang and Matt Rogers, Joe Pera, Todd Barry and Janine Garofalo, Connor O'Malley, Chris Gethard, and more.
Plus three bonus episodes that include two pilot episodes. Wow, two pilots must be good.
Find the feed at MaximumFun.org/BOCO, B-O-C-O.
Stands for bonus content.
Presenting the new MaxFunStore.com. We've got shirts for your torso, hats for your head, drinkware for your finest beverages, and so much more. Starring your favorite Max Fun shows with new and classic designs. Find the perfect gift for the podcast fan in your life. Heck, that could be you. We're not judging. Head to MaxFunStore.com now. That's MaxFunStore.com.
And we are back. Kirk, Maddie, it is time for one more thing. Maddie, start us off.
Sure. Okay, so mine is the case of the Golden Idol. I know we've already talked about it a lot, but I loved it so much.
We're going to talk about it more next week.
Not talk about it. Okay. If Elden Ring hadn't come out this year, this would probably be my favorite game of the year. And it kind of maybe is. Like every day since I've played it, I'm like, is this maybe my favorite game of the year? Is it maybe my favorite game, period? I don't know. That's how obsessed with it I was.
Yes.
I love this game. I played it too quickly. It's my only regret. I kind of had a whirlwind 24 hours of devouring it like an entire cake of some kind. So this is a mystery game. And we've explained it. We've attempted to explain it a couple times. It's pretty hard to explain how you put the clues together, but it feels great when you're actually doing it. So you'll look at sort of a static image of a murder or some other crime that's just been committed. I think they're all murders, but sometimes there are other peripheral crimes you also have to figure out in addition to a murder. And you'll kind of look around the room or series of rooms and click on people, and maybe they'll move a little bit, kind of like a GIF situation, but there won't be there won't be a heck of a lot of movement for you to follow. And you'll just click on people and you'll click on objects like an adventure game style. And as you click on certain objects, you can get keywords. And then you can put those keywords in order in your little notebook page. And that helps you delineate what the cause of the murder is, or what the deal is with all the people in the scene that you've just witnessed. And I don't know, the story of this game, like, I don't necessarily expect a mystery game like this to have an overarching story, or if it does, then I'm like, it's probably just going to be kind of boring. I mean, I don't know why I just had no expectations of that. Maybe because the very first mystery in the game is really linear. I mean, it's almost like a tutorial. And then
almost.
Well, I mean, it's almost like they're teaching you how to play the game or something. And I was just like, okay, if they're all going to be this simple, then I don't know if I'm going to like this game. But as it goes along, so you learn more and more about this golden idol, and it changes hands, and it has these weird superpowers, and you learn how it works, and that's really spooky. And then different characters emerge and take power over various other people's livelihoods, and you're like, wait, what? Why is that happening? And by the end of the game, I was like, totally blown away by the final mystery. Thought it was freaking nuts. Just, I don't know. I was going out of my mind with this one, guys. I can't forget it. It's freaking great.
It's amazing.
It's the coolest story ever.
We're going to talk about this some next week, but I do want to say I've been thinking a lot. The character designs in this game are actually
so
amazing.
So cool and weird.
The art is really weird, and at first it's a little off-putting, but there's especially one character who is just a real one. He's my favorite character in the game.
Which
you both,
one?
I'm sure, know who I'm talking about. I'm not even going to say his name.
Do you not want to reveal it? Okay.
I'll tell you off mic. Jason and I have talked about him. He's just the best character, and for reasons that are clear if you've played the game, he rules. And the very first time you meet him, his face is just ridiculous, and he is always making a ridiculous expression and doing something ridiculous, and he turns out amazing. And yeah, the
music is so weird and creepy.
Music is great. Right before the end of the game, Emily and I went back through every single mission, and we basically rebuilt the whole story ourselves. And that, I think, is what makes this story great. It's a cool story, but it's the fact that you tell it yourself. And doing that, sitting on the couch and be like, okay, so this guy was working for this. Okay, and then he did, and then he's here, and that's why this guy is here. And like, then there's an epilogue that sort of tells you everything. And we were like, haha, we worked this all out. Mm-hmm. And it was just like the experience
of... Like the epilogue makes sure you do that, even if you haven't already done it. And
which
even
is such a fun process.
I think it's the second to last mystery before the epilogue also has all the other previous mysteries and sort of forces you to go back and look at them. Like, the game does a great job of really reminding you who each character is so that there is that payoff at the end where you're like, what? That guy did what? Or at least that
it's
was
like
my
a
reaction.
Narrative design masterclass. Like, it's really on another level in terms of narrative design.
I'm afraid that it's not getting the attention it deserves because the art style is so off-putting.
But it ends up being
like
so great
in
when
the end,
you
it's
play
like,
it.
The
you're
best
like, the
things
art style owns.
You get, well, yes, this is what I said when I first introduced it to you guys. Like, the art style is off-putting at first, you fall in love with it over time.
Yes.
But when you first look at it, you're like that. When I first saw it, I was like, oh, no way am I going to play this. Like, it looks hideous. But
it's supposed
to
look hideous.
You need to get past that barrier.
Hideousness is incredible. Yeah, it's really ugly,
it's
beautiful.
It's a hideous game about hideous people. It's almost got like a little edge of horror to it. Like, especially that lighthouse song where it keeps changing keys and it just sounds
freaking creepy.
That
one is crazy. It's like a microtonal freak out. Yeah, where it keeps detuning. And I was losing my mind that whole level. Like, I can't listen to this anymore. Kirk here as I edit the episode, and as your sanity probably gradually deteriorates listening to this, just to shout out the composer on The Case of the Golden Idol, who is a composer named Kyle Misko, who did a great job. This tune is called Crowning Celebration, and man, it's good. Okay, back to the show.
It's iconic. The art style is like the visual version of whatever the hell
it
that
is,
song
it really
is.
It really is
doing.
Of like a steadily detuning song that's somewhere in between different tuning frequencies.
There's detuned art. Anyway, everyone needs to play this game. The Case of the Golden Idol. I really can't recommend it enough. It's definitely the best mystery game I've ever played, and I wish they would make a sequel like yesterday.
It's brilliant.
Kirk, what's your one more thing?
My one more thing is another really fun game that I played all the way through with Emily over the weekend called Escape Academy. Do either of you even know about this
game? Yes, I've heard of it, but go on.
It's so fun. It's super, super fun. This is a game that's on consoles and PC. It came out this year. There's already DLC for it. It's made by an indie studio called Coin Crew. And basically, it's escape rooms that you can play through in split-screen co-op with someone, and that's it. And they're designed by, they're really legit escape rooms. They're really cool. They're clearly designed by people who know how to make escape rooms. And there's just a bunch of them. And it's all wrapped in this very funny, very silly narrative package where you're a student at the Escape Academy where they teach people to escape. It sort of feels like Psychonauts, that same thing where everyone there, all the teachers are these big personalities who are master escape artists because that's important. And then there's like the bad guys or the anti-escape scientists that are, so it's just like, it's all, that's very silly. And it just looks kind of visual novelty and is totally like 2 seconds of the game. It's almost none of it. Almost all of the game is just, here we are, we're in the library and oh no, the library is on fire. We got to get out. And oh, well, our library is this ridiculous series of puzzles that you have to figure out. But it's super fun, especially in split screen co-op because you both are walking around the room and there's just a lot of like, okay, I'm going to go over here. Like I'm seeing this. All right, well, we've got this code here. All right, this looks like, you know, this is going to be a sort of a sequence that we need to figure out, but I don't know what the sequence means. So just keep an eye out for these shapes. You're kind of talking to each other a lot and then sharing inventory. One person looks at the wall. Okay, can you just look at the wall? I'm going to look off of your screen. screen while I enter this thing. And it's escape room stuff, so you develop a literacy for it as you go, which is also just cool because it's very consistently designed. They get challenging, but they're never too challenging. It never feels unfair. Honestly, it was just a super fun thing. Every night we did a couple of, I was like, you want to do an escape room? And Emily's like, yeah. And we would just do a couple. So it's really fun. Great. I had a great time with it.
Can you explain how the split screen works? So it's just like split in two? And
yeah, it's just split in two and the two of you walk around the room. It's like old school first person split screen.
Cool.
And like how you can cooperate to solve the puzzles? Like how does that
You
work?
Don't have to cooperate. It's more, the cooperation is more just that two of you can look at clues. I think one person could play through all the puzzles as well. It's, I think, a little easier with two just because you can cover more ground. And you can just like hand inventory items back and forth between
got
one
it.
Another.
That's so it'll be
like,
ask.
Oh,
yeah.
Like I have the, you know, I've got the candlestick, so I need to use it in that thing. Okay, I just gave it to you. You take care of this puzzle. I'm going to go into the other room, that kind of thing. But it's
That's
mostly
cool.
just talking
so it's like
and figuring it out.
As if you're like with a buddy at an escape
Yeah,
room
it just right. It feels like you're in an escape
this
room.
This sounds cool.
Really
I'm
going to
play this. I'm going to
It's great.
Get
You'll
my
like
wife
it.
On board.
Yeah, this sounds awesome.
Yeah. You guys will have fun. It's really, really fun. Cool. So that's Escape Academy. Cool game.
Cool. All right. My one more thing is a movie. I went to the movies last week and I went and saw Black Panther, Wakanda Forever.
Yeah,
which is,
I saw this too.
It's interesting watching it and like,
I can't wait.
It's interesting watching it and wondering like what they actually wanted to do with this movie.
Yeah.
Yeah, so it's very much a movie about like the death of Chadwick Boseman and what that means for the franchise. And for me, at least, like I thought it was okay, but that kind of subtracted from it. Like it detracted from the experience for me. The first Black Panther was so good. It was like the quintessential MCU movie, just like a great story, great villain, great writing, great quips, great performances, great action. Just like everything was firing on all cylinders and exploring like African culture in really interesting ways. This movie, like, I don't know, didn't hit the same beats for me because it was all about just like the death of the king and what they were all going to do to replace that. And it felt like the Marvel Cinematic Universe kind of talking to itself and being like, oh God, what are we going to do without Chadwick Boseman? And the replacement for him, the protagonist of this movie is Shuri, who is his sister, who was a side character in the first Black Panther. And she really, I mean, they bless the actress's heart out because she does her best with it. But like, she does not hold up as a protagonist, at least for me. She doesn't have like the charisma to carry the whole movie and does not work. They do introduce another character named Riri Williams who does have the charisma to carry a movie, and she's going to get her own show next year, so I'm very excited for that. I believe it's called Ironheart.
Yes. That's because she's like a cool teen girl Iron Man, basically.
Yes, she's like this brilliant teenager who's at MIT and like runs her own lab, and she stole every show, every scene she was in. And then she gets a suit for some reason, which is kind of silly. But yeah, Shuri did not really do it for me. The movie is all over the place. It's kind of like, in addition to dealing with grief and introducing Namor, who's pretty cool as a villain, and has some interesting themes around colonialism and just like it's interesting to see his whole deal. It also just kind of has all this like slapdash stuff with Julia Louis-Dreyfus, who just like is in there for no reason. Richard Schiff is in there also, like, and it's weird seeing Odin in there. Odin is in there.
Wow, okay.
Not really clear why. Like, Martin Freeman has this whole little subplot that goes nowhere and does nothing. Like, it feels like they're trying to plant seeds maybe for future MCU stuff, but it doesn't actually do anything. And it just it kind of like fits into this theme of all the MCU movies since Avengers Endgame, which is just kind of floundering, kind of like not really hitting the peaks of some of the previous stuff, like the original Black Panther. And so, yeah, for me, I didn't think it was all that great. Like, I walked away being like, okay, with the same kind of feeling that I had after the new Doctor Strange, after the new Thor, like, just like, okay, yes, I shoved this down my pie hole and, like, we'll probably not think about it again in a couple of months. And the MCU used to feel a lot less kind of, I don't know, factory made. And even the stuff with grief in here, like, it just didn't, it didn't do it for me. And I don't know how they could have salvaged a new Black Panther without recasting him, because Chadwick Boseman just so carried that first movie so well. But yeah, it just didn't really work for me that well. It was entertaining. It was fine. It was fun. It was good. But like, I don't know. It wasn't quite all there for me. Kirk, what did you think? You saw it too?
Yeah. I mean, I get what you're saying. Like, I think it was pretty impressive in some ways, just because, like, Ryan Coogler knows how to make a movie, and it was still more interesting, more amazing looking a lot of the time than most Marvel stuff. But I agree. I mean, it was, there's kind of 20% too much going on. Like, there's just a lot. Like, it just was a lot. And also, it's a pretty anguished movie, which there's kind of nothing for it. I mean, this is like their friend, their colleague. This is like, it wasn't just what do we do with this character. It's this guy died. And it was,
right,
to me, really moving. And there's some heartbreaking stuff where you really think about this actual beloved, amazing guy who died. And like, that stuff is tough. And then you're thinking about that the whole movie. And then also, right, it's this really tough story. And there's some anguished action scenes that are just hardcore. I mean, the whole movie, I was just like, man, this is a really heavy movie that's also got a lot going on. It's switching tones sometimes, like you said. There's more comic relief. There's more MCU-iness, just a bit more than the first Black Panther. So yeah, kind of a messy movie.
Yeah, very much all over the place. Very weird pacing, I think, to your point on that.
It was too much. So then you get pacing problems when you overstuff the sausage, right? Mm-hmm. It's like, it starts bulging in places. And it kind of felt that way. Even though, like, there was a lot to admire, and I still really liked it and enjoyed myself. I do agree that it was like maybe an impossible movie to make.
So
much. I mean, it was just so much going on.
I think it might have been handled. Like, I think the movie would have been better if they had either recast Black Panther or like even introduced a new hero. Because to me, I really think with a stronger protagonist to anchor it, it would have been better.
You know, I think Letitia Wright was pretty good. She's the actress who plays Shuri. I think she did a pretty good job.
No, yeah. I think the actress is good. I just think the character just like doesn't hold a movie together, at least for me. Like, she wasn't convincing as the new Black Panther. She wasn't really like, I don't know. She didn't feel like a protagonist to me.
It's tough. I mean, some of it is just I've been so into Andor and watching Andor that it's like so completely different in terms of focus and tone and energy level that then to go to even a wonderfully produced, amazing looking MCU like Marvel movie and to just sit there for 2.5 hours being just like completely sensorily overwhelmed was just like a lot to adjust to for me.
Mm-hmm. It was definitely a lot. But I will say again, Riri Williams, a.k.a. Dominique Thorne, who's the actress who plays Riri Williams, was fantastic. And I'm very excited for Ironheart, like after seeing her performance in this. So that's the one bright spot for me, is seeing that. And then obviously Julia Louis-Dreyfus, whenever she's on screen, it's amazing. It's just I didn't really know why she was on screen at all, ever. And that's not really ever answered. But yeah, I don't know. I'm still waiting for like the next big MCU thing that like actually blows me away. And isn't just like, okay, this is good, but I don't know, missing something.
Mm-hmm. Well, I'm going to watch it anyway.
No, you should. For sure. You should watch
it's absolutely worth watching.
Just like all the other recent MCU movies, it's one of those where if you ask me, like, should I go see it now or wait for Disney Plus, I would 100% be like, just wait for it to come to Disney Plus. Like, you don't need to go spend $18 on a movie ticket to go see this movie.
Fair enough.
Anyway. All right, that is it for this week's episode. Once again, happy Thanksgiving to everybody who is celebrating. And be sure to tune in. What is it, Monday we're going to run the Beans Cast?
Yeah, that'll be out next week.
God of War Ragnarok bonus episode coming next week. And otherwise, we will see you next week.
Go to the new store. Get some merch.
Yeah.
Get some merch.
Buy a Triple Click mug. Oh, man, I'm totally going to buy a Triple Click mug.
Heck yeah. All right, see both of you next week.
Bye.
Triple Click is produced by Jason Schreier, Maddie Myers, and me, Kirk Hamilton. I edit and mix the show and also wrote our theme music. Our show art is by Tom DJ. Some of the games and products we talked about on this episode may have been sent to us for free for review consideration. You can find a link to our ethics policy in the show notes. Triple Click is a proud member of the Maximum Fun Podcast Network, and if you like our show, we hope you'll consider supporting us by becoming a member at MaximumFun.org/join. Find us on Twitter at TripleClickPod, send email to TripleClick@MaximumFun.org, and find a link to our Discord in the show notes. Thanks for listening. See you next time.
MaximumFun.org.
Comedy and culture.
Artist owned.
Audience supported.
That was a BUY. buy stuff. B-U-Y.